Then George realized what it was that had been teasing his memory. Somewhere, long ago, he had seen a century-old newsreel of such an exodus. It must have been at the beginning of the First World War, or the Second. There had been long lines of trains, crowded with children, pulling slowly out of the threatened cities, leaving behind the parents that so many of them would never see again. Few were crying. Some were puzzled, clutching nervously at their small belongings, but most seemed to be looking forward with eagerness to some great adventure. And yet, the analogy was false. History never repeated itself. These who were leaving now were no longer children, whatever they might be. And this time, there would be no reunion. The ship had grounded along the water's edge, sinking deeply into the soft sand. In perfect unison, the line of great curving panels slid upwards, and the gangways extended themselves towards the beach like metal tongues. The scattered, unutterably lonely figures began to converge, to gather into a crowd that moved precisely as a human crowd might do. Lonely? Why had he thought that, wondered George? For that was the one thing they could never be again. Only individuals can be lonely, only human beings. When the barriers were down at last, loneliness would vanish as personality faded. The countless raindrops would have merged into the ocean. He felt Jean's hand increase its pressure on his in a sudden spasm of emotion.
Look, she whispered. I can see Jeff. By that second door.
It was a long way away, and very hard to be certain. There was a mist before his eyes which made it hard to see. But it was Jeff. He was sure of that. George could recognize his son now, as he stood with one foot already on the metal gangway. And Jeff turned and looked back. His face was only a white blur. At this distance, there was no way of telling if it bore any hint of recognition, any remembrance for all that he was leaving behind. Nor would George ever know if Jeff had turned towards them by pure chance, or if he knew, in those last moments while he was still their son, that they stood watching him as he passed into the land that they could never enter. The great doors began to close. And in that moment, Fay lifted up her muzzle and gave a low, desolate moan. She turned her beautiful, limpid eyes towards George, and he knew that she had lost her master. He had no rival now. For those who were left, there were many roads, but only one destination. There were some who said, "The world is still beautiful. One day we must leave it, but why should we hasten our departure?" But others, who had set more store by the future than the present, and who had lost all that made life worth living, did not wish to stay. They took their leave alone, or with their friends, according to their nature. It was thus with Athens. The island had been born in fire. In fire, it chose to die. Those who wished to leave did so, but most remained, to meet the end among the broken fragments of their dreams. No one was supposed to know when the time would be, yet Jean awoke in the stillness of the night and lay for a moment staring at the ghostly glimmer from the ceiling. Then she reached out to grasp George's hand. He was a sound sleeper, but this time he woke at once. They did not speak, for the words that were wanted did not exist. Jean was no longer frightened or even sad. She had come through to the calm waters and was beyond emotion now. But there was one thing still to be done, and she knew that there was barely time to do it. Still without a word, George followed her through the silent house. They went across the patch of moonlight that had entered through the studio roof, moving as quietly as the shadows it cast, until they came to the deserted nursery. Nothing had been changed. The floral patterns that George had painted so carefully still glowed on the walls. And the rattle that had once belonged to Jennifer Ann still lay where she had dropped it, when her mind turned into the unknowable remoteness it inhabited now. She has left her toys behind, thought George, but ours go hence with us. He thought of the royal children of the pharaohs whose dolls and beads had been buried with them 5,000 years ago. So it would be again. No one else, he told himself, will ever love our treasures. We will take them with us, and will not part with them. Slowly, Jean turned towards him and rested her head upon his shoulder. He clasped his arms about her waist, and the love he had once known came back to him, faint yet clear, like an echo from a distant range of hills. It was too late now to say all that was due to her, and the regrets he felt were less for his deceits than for his past indifference. Then Jean said quietly, "Goodbye, my darling," and tightened her arms about him. There was no time for George to answer, but even at that final moment he felt a brief astonishment as he wondered how she knew that the moment had arrived. Far down in the rock, the segments of uranium began to rush together, seeking the union they could never achieve. And the island rose to meet the dawn. Chapter 22. The ship of the Overlords came sliding in along its glowing meteor trail through the heart of Carina. It had begun its mad deceleration among the outer planets, but even while passing Mars, it had still possessed an appreciable fraction of the velocity of light. Slowly, the immense fields surrounding the sun were absorbing its momentum, while for a million kilometers behind, the stray energies of the star drive were painting the heavens with fire. Jan Rodericks was coming home, 6 months older, to the world he had left 80 years before. This time, he was no longer a stowaway, hidden in a secret chamber. He stood behind the three pilots. Why, he wondered, did they need so many? Watching the patterns come and go on the great screen that dominated the control room. The colors and shapes it showed were meaningless to him. He assumed that they were conveying information which, in a vessel designed by men, would have been displayed on banks of meters. But sometimes the screen showed the surrounding star fields, and soon, he hoped, it would be showing Earth. He was glad to be home, despite the effort he had devoted to escaping from it. In these few months, he had grown up. He had seen so much, traveled so far, and now was weary for his own familiar world. He understood now why the Overlords had sealed Earth from the stars. Humanity still had very far to go before it could play any part in the civilization he had glimpsed. It might be, though this he refused to accept, that mankind could never be more than an inferior species, preserved in an out-of-the-way zoo with the Overlords as keepers. Perhaps that was what Vindarten had meant when he gave Jan that ambiguous warning just before his departure.
"Much may have happened," the Overlord had said, "in the time that has passed on your planet. You may not know your world when you see it again."
Perhaps not, thought Jan. 80 years was a long time, and though he was young and adaptable, he might find it hard to understand all the changes that had come to pass. But of one thing he was certain. Men would want to hear his story, and to know what he had glimpsed of the civilization of the Overlords. They had treated him well, as he had assumed they would. Of the outward journey he had known nothing. When the injection had worn off and he had emerged, the ship was already entering the Overlord system. He had climbed out of his fantastic hiding place and found to his relief that the oxygen set was not needed. The air was thick and heavy, but he could breathe without difficulty. He had found himself in the ship's enormous red-lit hold, among countless other packing cases and all the impedimenta one would expect on a liner of space or of sea. It had taken him almost an hour to find his way to the control room and to introduce himself to the crew. Their lack of surprise had puzzled him. He knew that the Overlords showed few emotions, but he had expected some reaction. Instead, they simply continued with their work, watching the great screen and playing the countless keys on their control panels. It was then that he knew that they were landing, for from time to time the image of a planet, larger at each appearance, would flash upon the screen. Yet there was never the slightest sense of motion or acceleration. only a perfectly constant gravity which he judged to be about a fifth of Earth's. The immense forces that drove the ship must have been compensated with exquisite precision. And then, in unison, the three overlords had risen from their seats, and he knew that the voyage was over. They did not speak to their passenger or to each other, and when one of them beckoned to him to follow, Jan realized something that he should have thought of before. There might well be no one here, at this end of Karelin's enormously long supply line, who understood a word of English. They watched him gravely as the great doors opened before his eager eyes. This was the supreme moment of his life. Now he was to be the first human being ever to look upon a world lit by another sun. The ruby light of NGS 549672 came flooding into the ship, and there before him lay the planet of the overlords. What had he expected? He was not sure. Vast buildings, cities whose towers were lost among the clouds, machines beyond imagination? These would not have surprised him. Yet what he saw was an almost featureless plain, reaching out to an unnaturally close horizon, and broken only by three more of the Overlord's ships, a few kilometers away. For a moment, Jan felt a surge of disappointment. Then he shrugged his shoulders, realizing that, after all, one would expect to find a spaceport in some such remote and uninhabited region as this. It was cold, though not uncomfortably so. The light from the great red sun low down on the horizon was quite ample for human eyes, but Jan wondered how long it would be before he yearned for greens and blues. Then he saw that enormous, wafer-thin crescent reaching up the sky like a great bow placed beside the sun. He stared at it for a long time before he realized that his journey was not yet altogether ended. That was the world of the overlords. This must be its satellite, merely the base from which their vessels operated. They had taken him across in a ship no larger than a terrestrial airliner. Feeling a pygmy, he had climbed up into one of the great seats to try and see something of the approaching planet through the observation windows. The journey was so swift that he had time to make out few details on the expanding globe beneath. Even so near to home, it seemed, the overlords used some version of the star drive, for in a matter of minutes they were falling down through a deep, cloud-flecked atmosphere. When the doors opened, they stepped out into a vaulted chamber with a roof that must have swung swiftly shut behind them, for there was no sign of any entrance overhead. It was 2 days before Jan left this building. He was an unexpected consignment, and they had nowhere to put him. To make matters worse, not one of the overlords could understand English. Communication was practically impossible, and Jan realized bitterly that getting in touch with an alien race was not as easy as it was so often depicted in fiction. Sign language proved singularly unsuccessful, for it depended too much on a body of gestures, expressions, and attitudes which the overlords and mankind did not possess in common. It would be more than frustrating, thought Jan, if the only overlords who spoke his language were all back on Earth. He could only wait and hope for the best. Surely some scientist, some expert on alien races, would come and take charge of him. Or was he so unimportant that no one could be bothered? There was no way he could get out of the building, because the great doors had no visible controls. When an overlord walked up to them, they simply opened. Jan had tried the same trick, had waved objects high in the air to interrupt any controlling light beam, had tried everything he could imagine, with no result at all. He realized that a man from the Stone Age, lost in a modern city or building, might be equally helpless. Once he had tried to walk out when one of the overlords left, but had been gently shooed back. As he was very anxious not to annoy his hosts, he did not persist. Vin Darton arrived before Jan had begun to get desperate. The overlord spoke very bad English, much too rapidly, but improved with amazing speed. In a few days, they were able to talk together with little trouble on any subject that did not demand a specialized vocabulary. Once Vin Darton had taken charge of him, Jan had no more worries. He also had no opportunity of doing the things he wished, for almost all his time was spent meeting Overlord scientists anxious to carry out obscure tests with complicated instruments. Jen was very wary of these machines, and after one session with some kind of hypnotic device, had a splitting headache for several hours. He was perfectly willing to cooperate, but was not sure if his investigators realized his limitations, both mental and physical. It was certainly a long time before he could convince them that he had to sleep at regular intervals. Between these investigations, he caught momentary glimpses of the city and realized how difficult and dangerous it would be for him to travel around in it. Streets were practically non-existent, and there seemed to be no surface transport. This was the home of creatures who could fly and who had no fear of gravity. It was nothing to come without warning upon a vertiginous drop of several hundred meters, or to find that the only entrance into a room was an opening high up in the wall. In a hundred ways, Jan began to realize that the psychology of a race with wings must be fundamentally different from that of earthbound creatures. It was strange to see the overlords flying like great birds among the towers of their city, their pinions moving with slow, powerful beats. And there was a scientific problem here. This was a large planet, larger than Earth, yet its gravity was low, and Jan wondered why it had so dense an atmosphere. He questioned Vindartan on this, and discovered, as he had half expected, that this was not the original planet of the Overlords. They had evolved on a much smaller world, and then conquered this one, changing not only its atmosphere, but even its gravity. The architecture of the Overlords was bleakly functional. Jan saw no ornaments, nothing that did not serve a purpose, even though that purpose was often beyond his understanding. If a man from medieval times could have seen this red-lit city and the beings moving through it, he would certainly have believed himself in hell. Even Jan, for all his curiosity and scientific detachment, sometimes found himself on the verge of unreasoning terror. The absence of a single familiar reference point can be utterly unnerving, even to the coolest and clearest minds. And there was so much he did not understand, and which Vindartan could or would not attempt to explain. What were those flashing lights and changing shapes, the things that flickered through the air so swiftly that he could never be certain of their existence? They could have been something tremendous and awe-inspiring, or as spectacular yet trivial as the neon signs of old-time Broadway. Jan also sensed that the world of the Overlords was full of sounds that he could not hear. Occasionally, he caught complex rhythmical patterns racing up and down through the audible spectrum to vanish at the upper or lower edge of hearing. Vindartan did not seem to understand what Jan meant by music, so he was never able to solve this problem to his satisfaction. The city was not very large. It was certainly far smaller than London or New York had been at their heyday. According to Vindartan, there were several thousand such cities scattered over the planet, each one designed for some specific purpose. On Earth, the closest parallel to this place would have been a university town, except that the degree of specialization had gone much further. This entire city was devoted, Jan soon discovered, to the study